Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and today I'm getting a chance to talk with filmmaker Laura Farber. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you so much. It is the end of March, and here we are in the United States in 2020. And how has your life, how are you looking at life differently through the eyes of a filmmaker and a documentarian at this time? What is, before we go into We Are Columbine, please tell me a little bit about what's going on in your life and how you're thinking about it and how you're thinking about life and times in the United States in March of 2020 to 2024.
Well, yeah, you know, obviously it's an interesting time. Never experienced anything like this before and a pandemic. You know, but at the same time, I mean, I am, as a independent filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, work, you know, I work from home remotely
yep.
most of the time. So for me, this is, you know, more or less, I guess, business as usual. Now we just have a couple more people at the house with me working also simultaneously. So, you know, the bandwidth is slower than normal. But just trying to stay positive, getting, you know, I mean, just like I feel most people that I've talked to, getting outside as often as possible and, you know, taking the news in doses, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I found that, you know, the more time I spend, you know, I personally, I get my my news from mainly national and local news media outlets, so on the television, and, you know, spending too much time in front of that TV isn't really good for anybody, so I do get my little dose, go outside and read and, you know, just try. Actually, you know, this is a good time to, you know, for filmmakers too, to start working on development if they're not in the middle of a project. But going out and being able to film right now is impossible. So, so if there's any production going on, there is none. So, you know, that kind of makes it difficult as a freelancer as well. But as far as development, of our own ideas, this is the perfect time to do it.
It is, because it all, as a fellow film, as a fellow documentarian, I know that it all happens in pre-production. I mean, and post. Pre and post is really the magic times when you can either plan enough or edit enough to bring something together.
Right, right.
Okay, now let me tell you why. When I first contacted you and my producer, Renee Jaworski, contacted you,
mm-hmm.
and she connected us to We Are Columbine, and I got a chance to watch this extraordinary piece of work.
Thank you.
I was moved. And the artistry with which you put it together, the decisions that you made, who to include, to exclude the names of the perpetrators, and to make it the story of Gus and Zach and Jamie and Amy and Kiki and the rest of the people there. It was extraordinary. And I highly recommend it to anyone that wants to know a piece of American history. I want to know more about your story. Tell me who you were in the weeks after. Had you already gotten into the visual arts? Were you already in school when you were, how old were you in 1999 in April?
So in 1999, I was also a freshman at Columbine. So those were my Jamie, Amy, Zach, and Gus, and technically the teacher, Kiki, it was all our first year of high school. So, you know, and at that point, I was on the younger end, so most freshmen are 15, 14, 15. I was a 14-year-old. So that, you know, a lot of,
All the perspective of a 14-year-old has.
Yep. You know, and more or less, you know, in the beginning, it was, you know, just like Zach says in the film, what are you going to wear? You know, just trying to get from point A to point B, get to class on time, not get in trouble, and, you know, just show up. I think attendance was very important for us at our school. And so, you know, just, again, like Zach in the film, I mean, you know, not finding out we weren't going back to school was a very big memory and a shock at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when did the light in your own consciousness, the lights of, wait a minute, mm-hmm. I want to do something in the visual arts, really begin to take hold and root in Laura Farber's consciousness?
Well, honestly, I would really before Columbine, I have to give credit to my mom and dad. You know, not only did we watch a lot of film. My dad suggested films for me to watch just as a kid and growing up. We watched them together. We went to movies. There was a lot of visual and audio representation just growing up for me. So I knew that was important. But also in high school, I did participate in our video production class. it's silly to look back on because I still have some, you know, especially when going through footage for the film, I got to see a lot of the homemade videos that we did, you know, for class. And so that seed was always there. My father went to Columbia College in Chicago, you know, back in the 70s. It was a liberal arts college. And that's also where I went. And that's where I went to film school. My dad was also a photographer for UPI. And while I don't, technically, I didn't get his eye, his visual eye, but the storytelling eye, I think we both share that.
I love how you say that, because it is the visual arts. It's extraordinary to be able to see a director of photography and what they can do, because I watched in We Are Columbine, and that shot when Gus has his hands on his head, and so there's mm-hmm. that triangle, and there's a shot through there. And then there's that low shot as kids are walking out, slow-mo, out of the room, and the low shot, the kinds of preparation and extra shots that had to do in order to make that there, it was breathtaking. It was just the artistry that was there, and some of the slow tracking moves that were just gently. I just sat there and paused it. I mean, I took so much longer than a normal than watching it, just watching the artistry that was put into that piece.
That is a lot of Mr. Joseph Fitzgerald. The DJ was fantastic, and we did. I mean, his ideas. Were always at the forefront I took his advice and suggestions to heart, and they were important because this was my first documentary, and not only was it my first feature, which, you know, I don't know that I'd go out that hard again and that strong with doing a feature before maybe completing a short. However, you know, it was first time, and it was very personal. So I think, and I wanted to have my director's hat on, right? It's what I went to school for. That's what I've always wanted to do. I get to tell a story that's super personal, but yet there's a learning curve. So I'm so grateful that I had other producers as well as the director of photography, Joe, there with me, you know, to get this done. And the school, I mean, the access was incredible. I know, actually, you know, that Frank DeAngelis, the principal at the time and up until 2014, I mean, he gave us that access, and I don't think he would have done it for anybody else that wasn't alumni, you know. So that was obviously an important character in the story.
Totally. All right, let's go back again. So to get this here, you then move in a career, you get your degree. What mm-hmm. happens? Where do you go? Here you've got a brand new spanking degree, or did you do interning?
Well, you go work in the bars. No.
Gotta work in the bars. Yeah. I'm sorry, that was awesome, but go ahead.
No, I think after graduation, it was definitely tough. I did get an internship at
Anchor me time-wise. By the way, I'm 71 years. I'm 71 years old, so you'll see my span of time, my span over history. So this is yours over here. So you're in 2006, and so you're out of school. Where are you?
In Chicago.
In Chicago.
Downtown.
Got it. All right. And?
Then got an internship at WLS, ABC, local. More of their lifestyle pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Did that, I think, for about a year and a half, and then got swept up in the Towers Productions, which is a small production company in Chicago, and we worked on stories for the Weather Channel, the History Channel, the Learning Channel, and they're subcontracted out, and I worked on shows like Gangland, When Weather Changed History, a couple of jail shows, and then some stuff in Cook County Jail, so...
As you were
watching, that was a real break.
I'll bet. As you were watching the directors, and you were watching the EP, the executive producers, and watching the director of photography and all. Were you sitting there going, "Yeah, I want to do that"?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. The whole time, I. It was so fun, my favorite part of documentary filmmaking is being in the field. I think it's the best, and I think that's where the stories happened. And also, being able to work on these shows, I got to be there from the beginning, so the development through shooting, through post, and then out the door, and then also fact-checking the shows. So it's... You're there at every stage, and so that was just a great introduction into this field. But also, there you're working for somebody else, and I just knew if there's a story I wanted to tell, it would have to be on my own terms, where I get to be the executive producer.
How cool! So this is, did you form Lioness Productions for that?
Yes. I decided that. While the reality television paid the bills, it wasn't fulfilling as far as some of the stories that were being told. I didn't connect with a lot of them in that way. I loved working on it, but I wanted to tell my own story in my own way and definitely make a documentary, long format versus, the shorter form for television.
How cool. So... because we had to get you, I'm having to get you into, okay, I'm going to pitch this and I'm going to decide to do it. So take me into it.
Mm-hmm. So I think after I was still doing the reality TV at the time, I knew it was, winding down, contracts were ending. And I received my 10-year reunion card from Columbine High School to attend our reunion. And I thought, I left. I went away to school. I left the state of Colorado. So I wonder what everyone else is doing. And also another, the Columbine reunions were also coming up. So
yeah.
I just started thinking, how is everybody feeling? Are they talking about it? I didn't talk to my friends. I mean, some of them I stayed in touch with, but, we stay in touch. We're not talking about the shooting on April 20th. So,
exactly.
Yeah. So I was just curious. And I thought, this is my story. And what's everyone doing? Let's check in. And so from there, I thought maybe I'll film the reunion. Our freshman class. That's who I want to focus on. That's what I know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found out I couldn't go to the reunion and film it.
Wow.
So that privacy as well.
Got
as,
it.
It's the community is not comfortable having cameras around.
Good.
Period.
I can understand that. There's a voyeuristic element that and something that no one who has not gone through it can truly get. So how did you approach it then? What was the evolution?
Well, I didn't get it, to be honest. I thought, you know what, I'm one of you. I think it's okay. I think it's been 10 years since this happened. And I think we should start talking about it. And then I started, going the filmmaker route of, well, okay, we'll turn the audio off. I don't have to interview anybody. If I just put a camera in the corner and get a wide shot, it's just, our whole freshman class, and, they weren't going for it. So then it just became, what am I trying to do here? Who can I talk to? And so I found a freshman friend, and that was Amy. And I just asked her, I was like, would you be willing to sit down with me and just kind of talk about what we experienced that day, what you've been doing since then? I found out she was a social worker, and I thought, well, I wonder if that had anything to do with our experiences that day. She was sort of like, she's a test dummy for the whole film.
She's fierce, isn't she? God,
she's
a warrior.
Can you tell?
Oh man, I can. I was like, yeah. I want her on my side.
Yeah. She's definitely fierce. And you can tell, I think, in the film how close we are. And it's just, I think that first day of filming with her in her basement in Boston without Joe, the DP, by myself using his equipment. I just said, let's just try this. And it failed. I mean, the equipment failed. I did a terrible job. None of that footage is in the film because the DP said absolutely not. So, and I bless him for that. When I was interviewing Amy, that was my the first time I remembered that we were together on April 20th at the cafeteria table. And that... I mean, then the wheels started turning. What else don't I remember? Do other people not remember? I mean, the question is just my curiosity really got out of control. And so I couldn't stop.
Wonderful.
And then the other layer of let's go to the school. Let's see who else we can get. And then it was just a sort of, slow domino effect of participants. But the one thing I can say is that how I got them all on board was I promised that I wouldn't say the name of the two people that were involved.
Perpetrators, yes.
As well as I promised not to show the CCTV cafeteria footage from that day. Because, we've just seen it. I just wanted to make something that we haven't heard, we haven't seen, and coming from the voices – from the people who were actually experienced it was really important. I felt like everything we've seen up until then was from an outsider's perspective. So.
How did you pitch this so that you would get the funding in order to do this? Who did you go to? What did you do? How did you think of that? How much earlier from the time you were in that basement with Joseph's equipment?
I wasn't thinking of any of that. I just thought, what are you going to, what would you charge me for X, Y, and Z to get X, Y, and Z done? And then from there, it was deferred. I mean, a lot of our stuff was deferred. A lot of people worked for free.
Beautiful.
And it was, the rest of it was independently funded, self-funded.
How wonderful.
I wouldn't recommend that. Yes, it is wonderful.
I would not either.
Reality.
No. But...
grateful it happened.
Let me ask you, if you were going to do a sculpture and you were going to bring everyone in to work on this sculpture because you needed to do this sculpture, you would do it this way. As hard as it is, as much as you wouldn't do it. This is personal.
No, it had to. Yeah. There was a point where I just kept, I kept reminding myself that this has to be told, this story has to be told. And then just serendipitous things happened throughout filming that kept me on track. And, and at some point early on, very early on, filmmaker has to ask themselves, which is unfortunate because you want both. You know, are you trying to make money from your film, or are you trying to tell a story and help, you know, social change for that matter? And I think you have to make that decision. And at the time, I just said, I'm not going to. I just want to make this however it gets done. If you make money, it makes money, whatever. But that's not the point. The point is just get it made. And that, you know, that did get it done. But, you know, there were people along the way that wanted to change that. You know, I did actually, I pitched it to CNN. That didn't go well because I found that the folks that wanted to participate financially also had their own ideas of how the film should be made, and that they didn't connect with what I saw happening. And I just saw it turning into something that's already been done before. And so I knew I had to keep it in-house, more or less, which then you bear that financial burden if that's the route you're going to go.
Right. And that's what you did. And so as you got all this footage and you sat down in post, talk about that experience. You have all – did you edit along the way so that you knew holes that you would be filling in? Did you have to go back and re – I mean, talk about the experience. Mm-hmm. People don't understand who have not done it.
No.
The process that it takes for you to do something that is coherent and deeply moving and rhythms on the way through. And the fact that you took – I love the perspective of – that these are freshmen who are going to have to live this for 4 years as opposed to a senior who is going to be doing and then going out. I think that was profound to me. Anyway, irrespective of that, I'm sorry, I'm such a fanboy. I'm having a hard time.
Okay. No, this is great. Always talking film and documentaries with other storytellers is the best. So I definitely appreciate it. And yeah, and then so editing, I would say I in edit for probably a total of 5 years, if I could argue that. We had some personal moves in between filming. We moved from Chicago to Minneapolis. I got stuck in post production. I didn't have the resources, took some time, thought I could edit myself. Found out that wasn't going to work, too close to it. Spent some time. I had some editors cut some scenes. Those carried through till the end. I also finally got all my footage together and put together I think it was 2.5 hour string rough cut. Gave that to an editor. Then I got some post producers on board in Minnesota, and they put me in touch with a post house where I found the wonderful editors at Channel Z and the graphics there. And then I found a composer there. And so once they put me in contact with some people and I started working with other human beings, that was good, because that whole time I was by myself in a room with my computer and all the footage, and the footage was great because I had a lot of it from high school. Stuff that I kept the tapes or whatever, or was able to go back and get the tapes. So I had everything here. It was just going through it was tough, but you know what? It was a blessing because I got to sit by myself and look at it and go through some, you know, cry sessions, because that footage brings up a lot, right? From freshman year all the way to senior year, and just looking for stuff and finding. I mean, that's part of the way how I found Jamie, believe it or not, was looking through old photos. And I looked at her and I go, well, we used to swim. I wonder what she's doing. You know, reached out and she wanted to talk about her story finally. And she said, I can't believe this is happening. I've been wanting to talk about it. I said, holy shit, nobody else wants to talk about it. So this is great. Yeah. So that's when I said serendipitous things happened, I think that was that's an example of one. So literally once I had the whole team on board, then the train started just flying.
God, and to be able to see, to be able to sit there during, you know, the thing is that Laura, I find that I'm interested in that Watson Crick moment, you know, when they go, aha, double helix, DNA, I've got it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also interested in what it was like an hour before that moment. And what was it like 2 hours, 2 weeks before that moment, before they were ready? So that with you sitting there, what was it like 2 weeks before things began to come together? How you kept going and kept yourself going so that serendipity, which I believe is a feature of the universe. It requires us to show up, but it's an actual feature. It works in my, you know, at 71, I swear to God, this has happened to me so often that it cannot be coincidence. It's out of line, but it requires me to show the F up.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Well, and I think, the 20 minutes before that time before, those are the lowest parts, right? That's where you're down and out and you're like, I don't know where this is going to go. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I don't have enough people. I don't know where the story is going to go. I mean, there's a lot of that of just ruminating, and just of anxiety. But if you stay in that for just a little bit and that serendipitous moment comes up, You regain strength and it's like a hurricane, you know? I promised people, you know, I was going to do this, and then people got on board and they felt like it could actually help survivors in the future. And I thought, well, there aren't going to be lots of survivors. I hope that there are no more shootings. And I mean, when we started filming, Sandy Hook happened, I think a month later, and, that kept me going, right? Every shooting that's happened since then kept me going.
Exactly.
But
I'm a Joss Whedon fan, Buffy, Angel, Firefly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he really talks about this. This is why I feel like your piece is so much broader than the shooting. And this is not. And bombing. It's not to minimize it. I'm not minimizing it in the least, but it's much broader. High school can be hell. The separation, mm-hmm. the differences, how we're learning, how we're growing, and what you showed was the life of people as they grew through not only the trauma that all of us face, certainly not to the degree or to the drama as it is. That's the hook. But the life, the human stories of growing and dealing with our own bullshit, our own work that we have to do on our souls. That's what was so profound in watching these four, the five and six, the people that are telling the story through there. That's what moved me so much, Laura.
Yeah. Well, that was the point. I just, I do feel like we were, you hear the word Columbine and, I can just imagine what goes through someone's mind, but I can assume it has to do with the shooting there in 99. Sure. And I just thought there's so much more than just that word and that day.
More
on people and then also what it looks like to carry that with us as a teenager into adulthood. And you do carry it,
Sure. I don't think it's something
that
we change.
Yeah. Right. Right.
I've talked with so many of survivors of sexual abuse during my life and it's much more prevalent than people are acknowledging, and working through not just the trauma, but working through that opportunity of healing. How do we heal? How do we get past? How do we grow? How do we get stronger? How do we reach out to one another? These are all the kinds of stories that you're telling in this film.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a universal trauma story for sure. Yeah, and trying to get people to understand that you know, that we can't compare our traumas too, you know, just mm-hmm. because you went through, you know,
thank you.
You know, you've got your, you know, your sexual abuse also yep. behind, you know, that's a trauma. And then there's a mass shooting, and then there's a, you know, a pandemic, and then there's,
yep.
you know, a natural disaster and so on. So I think it touches everyone
right.
at some point, and you really had nothing in your life. So it's been, yeah.
All right, Laura, I always yes. ask this of painters, or I ask this of a musician, when, or a filmmaker, when do you know it's enough? Is it just because the date, the timeline, we've run out of seconds and it's going to be on the screen there, or do you go, okay, it's enough? What was that moment like?
I would say 70% was internal, knowing it was time. And then, yeah, the other 30 is, you know, literally someone telling you, you've run out of money, I'm done working, or, you know, time is up.
That's it.
Or you have to work really hard. You know, and I wonder that. I wonder, does every filmmaker, you know, do
yes.
they love every film that they've made? Do you know?
No.
There are parts of my film that, you know, make me cringe, but yet it's someone else's favorite. So I try
yeah.
to remember that, but I would have kept going. There's some things that, you know, I think you'll always want to change, but at the end of the day, big picture.
Okay.
You know, I just think, you know, with the help of other people telling you it's time.
Exactly. That's the universe
mm-hmm.
says, okay, Laura, there's other things
yeah,
we
enough.
Need you to do. Yeah.
yeah.
Okay. So what was the experience like showing this, going to a showing, standing at the back? Did that happen? Did it work
mm-hmm.
that way? How did, what was that? What was that experience of watching your baby, the thing you poured your heart, your life, your soul in, and there it is on the screen, and there's an audience.
Oh, it's insane. It was most unforgettable moment I've had. I think it, exactly right. I birthed, you know, my baby for 7 years, right? I've been working on it for 7 years, and finally. And it wasn't so much, you know, I don't think my fear or anxiety came from people liking it or not liking it. It was
no.
just the fact that sitting in the back of the room, which is where I chose to sit for that first screening. It was so intense. I felt every, and I still do when I watch the film, you feel what the audience is feeling.
Sure.
You laugh when they laugh, hopefully. And there were times where some people laughed and I didn't think they were going to laugh. And that just makes
yeah.
it just makes it all better. And that people were learning. I think, you know, it was well received. And that was, it was also a hurdle though, just to get butts in seats, just based on the topic. I think people were afraid
uh-huh.
of the topic, you know, just the word Columbine. I can't, you know, I don't want to watch that, or it's too sad. And there, obviously, you know, there's some sad parts, but there's also some light moments because that's life.
Yeah. And that's what I love about the title. It's very present. Mm-hmm. It's not a past. It's not
right.
we were Columbine. It's we are. And it's a present. It's
right.
present tense. And that present tenseness gave me a permission to watch the film differently than I had it been different.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, all right, now. But it's over with this. Now you're going through. You've now passed this child out onto the world, and you're going, okay. Now, what's next?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. What's next is I'm still doing some screenings. The film is still relevant, fortunately, and I wanted to.
Are you
to
kidding me? It is more getting more relevant than less because of the profound way that you wove this together. All right. Anyway, continue.
Thanks. Thank you. You don't want it after 7 years. It's a hard pill to swallow to then say, well, exactly now what? My baby's out there, but I'm not quite ready to give the baby up.
Good.
I think as long as people still want to see the film and can, you know, we have amazing Q&As after and discussions after the film that I've been participating in, and it's awesome. People are coming around to different ideas and different ways of looking at things, especially, you know, I don't know if this is the route we're going, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, especially Second Amendment related audience.
Yep.
Members, that's been the most surprising, is because that wasn't the goal of the film at all. I get asked that
nope.
question all the time, you know, it's because we are Columbine, so it must be about guns, you know, it's just
sure.
funny because it's not, but it is in a sense.
It
I'm
is.
Finding now that people are looking at it in a different light, finally, which is nice.
Well, you know, I find that interesting that you would say that, because when there's a piece of art in a museum, you will see people come up to it, and we will bring our own story to that piece of art. And then we'll take something away that will be completely different that the sculptor would, or the painter would have thought would have. So,
right.
And so you're seeing the same thing. Because of this issue, there is a lot of, there's a lot of heat around the issue of
mm-hmm.
Of the Second Amendment, and what does it mean, and how do we deal with it? How do we have a conversation about it? When I was growing up in South Texas, we would have a shotgun, and in a shotgun, like either an automatic or a pump shotgun, there would be they required us to have a plug. So that you could only have two in the magazine and one in the chamber. So a total of three. Normally it's set up
mm-hmm.
for five. But in order to limit the match, so that you would give the game a chance, no one complained. This was just the way it was all over. They understood that it was so that was a mindset that we've gone crazy
right.
from. And so how do we have this conversation? So when you're talking, when people come here that are second, are they looking for ways to engage, or ways that we can engage in order to have a sane conversation about this, to have some kind of sanity about having a conversation or being willing to?
Right. Well, and I think so, you know, since the release, I also think that the idea, you know, especially after Marjorie Stoneman Douglas,
yep.
And those kids at Parkland, the idea of preventing gun violence, you know, definitely come to the forefront. And I do believe that people are ready to advocate for change. But to be honest, I mean, they have no idea where to start, right? And especially for the NRA members, Second Amendment supporters, gun owners.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've all wondered for a long time how they can advocate for change while still protecting their rights.
Exactly.
And so I'm hoping, you know, this film, I think, can bring out, you know, hopefully people will stop worrying about that part and worry more about what needs to happen to prevent gun violence, that it's not, you know, shifts the focus. You know, and there are bipartisan groups that can unify and come together
mm-hmm.
and advocate for change without judgment or criticism. And the film has helped do that in some communities, you know, depending on where you live. We had an amazing screening in Pennsylvania in a small, small, small town where the majority of that town are Second Amendment supporters and gun owners. And
yep.
they showed up to the film, and they had really interesting comments, and they're ready. They want to help. And I think after seeing how gun violence affects people, shows them that it's not necessarily about the guns and taking your gun away. It's more about preventing the violence against our children and each other. And how can
yes.
we do that? And we have to work together, obviously, because this is, we were talking about this right after Columbine in 99, and here we are.
And so what are you, so you're going around, are you sending out opportunities to screen the film? Are you, give me an idea of what Laura's day and next few months look like that you're thinking about.
Yeah, I think we're definitely we've been sending out more or less pitches and proposals, universities, first responders, different schools here. So I'm in. You said you grew up in South Texas. I'm in North Texas right now. That's where I live, in Dallas. New to Dallas, also.
Congratulations!
Thank you.
How long have you been there?
Okay, so I keep saying no, but we're still new. 2 years, I think.
Still
considered new.
Are you? I'm in Pflugerville, which is right above Austin, a little hat right on Austin that sits on top of it. And you are in North Dallas, South Dallas. What part?
We're in Northeast Dallas.
Okay. All right. What's that experience like coming to Texas? As your perspectives from outside of Texas, what you heard about Texas, come here. Do you have family here now?
No.
Okay. So you are, here you are in Texas, other than
mm-hmm.
family of choice, right? And getting into
that.
That's family to me, and blood family and family of choice are really blended now. We're all cousins. We either are in this together or we're not.
Right.
But anyhow, so what's your experience and looking at the mindset and that you're seeing here in Dallas?
Well, to be honest, I was a little nervous before because we were coming from Minneapolis. So straight down, and I thought everyone had a gun. Everyone had a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to show off their guns, you know, like, wait, I mean, you know what, just craziness, you know, cowboy hats, cowboy boots, the whole just cartoon nonsense image in my head. And then I got to Dallas specifically and it was not that. So very metropolitan. I was nervous. I had no reason to be nervous now after living here.
Yes.
Yeah, I
so
mean,
how's
you know,
the
there's,
artistic
there's a gun culture here?
Sure.
Nothing like what I experienced though in Pennsylvania recently.
How's the artistic and the film culture and this that you're connecting with to see the kind of talent that you can collaborate with?
So I'm still finding my footing here, because I've been so focused on my baby and We Are Columbine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I honestly, the film scene isn't as big as I thought it was going to be, but
yeah.
I mean, we're freelance, so we have to adapt and bounce around anyway. So like I said, a lot of development happening at Lioness Productions.
Sure.
And
do you keep a tickle file? Do you begin to have an idea that begins to coalesce and then pitch it to another producer that you have? How does the process of being an independent producer, Laura, at this time,
mm-hmm.
how does it look like? How does it give us some kind of a story picture, as vague as it can be? I mean, believe me, I understand that that these things have to be vague, like planting a bunch of seeds and seeing which one sprouts.
Oh, totally. Well, I think first and foremost, collaborating with other producers in other states. You know, I have producer friends and post production people that still live in Chicago, you know, that I maybe went to college with. We still collaborate and I bounce ideas off him. He'll call me for something. And so that's really nice, especially even remotely is better than than working alone. I decided this time around on the next project, whatever that is, I'm going to work with another producer all the time. You know, the Columbine thing was definitely on my own for a while. And not, I mean, with filming, had producers, but as far as the story and structuring, I was alone for a lot of it. And I don't think I would want to do that again.
No, I'm a writer's room guy. I gotta get into the writer's room and bounce things off because on myself, I just cannot get the kinds of insights that I need unless I have the collaboration.
Oh, yes, exactly. And I think that's where I definitely stumbled before and, you know, more or less wasted a lot of time by not, you know, working with people, and not because I was hiding my idea. I didn't want someone to steal it. It was just, you know, just self-criticism all day of this isn't ready. It's not ready. It's not ready. But until you show somebody something, it'll never be ready.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I think,
No, you talk.
Well, no, I was just going to say, I think, you know, the next time I always joke that after when I was doing Columbine, that my next project would be on something lighter like puppies. But I definitely think it's going to be a different topic on the next project. I think maybe something animal related is on the forefront for sure right now.
But what I loved about what you did with And We Are Columbine is that one of the things that I'm always so aware of, whether I watch a dramatic piece. Comedy, whatever it is, or documentary, is how soon do you make me care? How soon do I get invested in the story?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you did. I was invested right away. And that's what you're going to be carrying with you and carrying forward to every single piece you tell, because I know this just from watching this first piece and what you turned down from CNN and the other places was that aspect of it.
Thank you. That's very thoughtful. And, I appreciate that. Because you never know what your next project's going to be, you know, and I kept thinking that if We Are Columbine does well, you know, financially, that leads to your next project, right? If We Are Columbine does well, not financially, but maybe artistically, that could also lead to your next project. So that's kind of where we are, right in the middle.
Right in the middle.
Right now.
Well, thank you
as always.
As always, as we are, because that's what life is. Life is in the present, like the title, We Are Columbine. Life is lived in the present tense. We tend to think of it, we carry our baggage from the past, and then we project our worries out from the future. But that's not how it's lived. It's lived in the present tense. And that's what you have to do, where you have to hang up this phone and do the next thing that you're having to do and the ideas that are coming up and what we're going to do and how we're going to continue on together. Is there anything I haven't asked about that you really want to talk about today? You don't have to really want to talk about it, just want to talk about it today in the last few minutes that I have the grace of talking with Laura Farber.
No, I think just the fact that, you know, you had me on is helpful, and it means a lot, and it keeps the conversation going, which is, I think, what we need right now. And that's important. So I really appreciate this conversation that we had.
Yeah, so do I, Laura. And I look forward to getting a chance to follow your career. And I'm so glad that you're in Texas. We need you here. And that's the other part is what I love about the bandwidth continuing to grow. It allows us to collaborate, not just because of where we are physically located, but you can have your editor in Minneapolis. You can have your executive team in Los Angeles or in Kansas City or in Miami or wherever it is. or that we can do this in a collaborative form that does not have to preclude us having to be physically together at that instant.
Right, exactly.
And that's what I want us to do together. Anyway, thank you so much, Laura, for the time that you've given me today, and I look forward to getting a chance to not just to follow your career, but to have another conversation as you continue on this process, because I would like to be there while I'm not going to be so creepy as to say I want to be there at the conception. I do want to be there during the gestation. And because I would love to have I'd love to have another conversation with you in a mid process, how you're thinking, what you're doing, what you're learning about yourself as a storyteller, and during the process, rather than just at the end while it's done, so that we can see how that evolution happens. Would you be willing to have that conversation?
100%. 100%.
All right. Wonderful.
No, that's great. Thank you.
What a pleasure. All right. This is Dennis Tardon with a conversation with Laura Fauber, and we will talk to you soon. Thank you. Bye, Laura.
Bye. Thanks, Dennis.